1996 Sunstone Symposium welcomes you to Session 161, The Unorthodox Pedagogy of Lowell L. Bennion. The panel consists of Frederick S. Buchanan, John W. Bennion, and Earl Harmer.
I am not Fred Buchanan. My name is John Bennion, and I'm here in part to excuse Fred, who had an emergency that took him out of the city, and he felt very badly that he couldn't be a part of this discussion. Fred and I were contemporaries at the University of Utah when we took classes from Lowell during those years together, and I know he has a lot of feelings about the impact of Lowell Bennion as a teacher. So it will be Earl Harmer and myself, and we will each make some remarks, some observations about Lowell as a teacher as we remember him, and then we will hope that that will stimulate some discussion and some offerings on the part of some of you who are also students of his at one time or another. Earl Harmer is a former faculty member at the University of Utah in the Graduate School of Education, where I now am. Retired for a little while, I guess, Earl?
2 months.
2 months is all? Well, that is a short time. He had a long and distinguished career at the University of Utah and was also once a student of Lowell's. So he is going to first and reflect on his experiences as a student of Lowell and his memories, and then I'll make some remarks and then we'll open it up.
When Fred called and asked me to participate in this session, I said, Fred, when Lowell was my teacher, that was half a century ago, 53 years ago. That's asking quite a bit to go back to that time. But that's exactly what I'm going to try to do, along with connecting some experiences that I had with Lowell as a teacher when we were both colleagues at the U. So you'll be appreciative and grateful that this is quite short, and it's quite short because my memory of 53 years ago is quite short. The autumn of 1943 was an exciting, heady time for me. I just graduated from East High School along with 400 classmates at the end of the 11th grade, which was a routine kind of procedure then, changed during the period of time that John's father was superintendent. World War II was global, but clearly the good guys were winning. I was 17. I planned to enlist in the Army Air Force, and I did so that October. I was a freshman at the U, and I've got music that I didn't... Can you hear? Okay. I was a freshman at the U, again, along with many of my high school friends, and twice a week I trotted down to the LDS Institute on University Avenue, then and now an LDS chapel, to sit at the feet of Lowell Bennion and T. Edgar Lyon. I remember the Institute as a social center more than a learning center. At any time, day or evening, I could find lots of pretty girls. We were planning parties, committees, working on dances, lots of war-related kinds of activities. Almost everyone worked at some part-time job, again because the war made employment easily available, and Depression economics required that everyone, at least in my group, buy his or her own clothes and pay for dates and tuition. Incidentally, tuition at the U then was $35, plus a few dollars for books and fees. I also remembered that the classes were full, even crowded. It was not part of the team culture then to skip classes, nor to be anything but attentive, responsive students. I'm probably wrong on that, but that's the way I remember it. I cannot recall any instance of misbehavior, feigned boredom, or sloughing. It was a serious time. Everyone knew someone whose brother or father had been killed or wounded. We didn't know in 1943 how long the war would last, but we did know that we boys would be involved within the year. We it was in this context that Lord Bunyan taught. He and Tia Gilly, of course, were responsible for everything else associated with institute life, but primarily they were teachers. I suspect that they taught about 15 hours a week, although it could have been more. They were deservedly regarded as excellent teachers. My intent today is to focus on Lowell Bunyan as classroom teacher, specifically his teaching methodology, but necessarily his teaching purposes, his interactions with students, and his version of grades and evaluation. I need to provide just a bit more background information about my relationship with Lowell. When I returned to the U.S. as an associate professor of educational studies in 61, Lowell was dean of men. I believe I'm accurate about that date, but it could have been 62. He was dean of men, and administrative job long since appropriately abolished. Soon after I came on campus, I was appointed to the Student Behavior Committee, chaired by Laura Bunyan. I served on that committee for 5 years, becoming chairman myself eventually. Anyway, I had frequent and close contact with Lowell during that time. Also, during the late 1960s, I arranged for my son to spend 2 summers at the ranch in close to Victor, Idaho. In addition, there were numerous occasions when Lowell and I met on other university business, and occasionally we would simply meet accidentally and sit and talk. I did not socialize with Lowell. I hope he had a social life, but I don't know. I knew Lowell better as a colleague than him as a student, but it is to Lowell as teacher that I want to turn. I'm indebted, incidentally, to a lot of friends whom I contacted and said, "Do you recall Lowell as a teacher, and what do you recall?" And we spent some time attempting to ferret out some of the memories that we had of Lowell as a teacher. Lowell as teacher was consistent with Lowell as person, or saint. That is, his classroom manner was quiet, sincere, confident, and focused. Lowell was not a comedian, egocentric, or dramatic. He walked in front of and within the class group. I never recall his using a podium or lectern. He made constant eye contact with the class. He was sensitive to the attitude and responsiveness of individuals and of the class as a group. Lowell began each class session with an attention-getting, climate-setting comment or incident. Frequently, these were unrelated to the content for a day. He might mention a national or local event, a problem or issue that was current in the news, or the activities or accomplishments of someone within the community. Then Lowell would, usually with a book in his left hand, talk about the content or lesson for the day. He might review what happened last class session. He helped the class focus on new material. Lowell's educational purpose, I believe, was quite simply to get students to think about the material, themselves, the society, or some issue or problem. He would, for example, use the material of Mark in the New Testament to consider the role of personal responsibility in the current affairs. Lowell would frequently ask questions for which he, Lowell, did not have the answers. He would take some class time to establish a problem or a dilemma, and once established, Lowell would encourage students to speculate, to imagine, to consider the consequences of one position or another. Lowell was aware of context variables. He would note the differences in the times that might account for alternate explanations of things. Lowell was also sensitive to the changes and evolutions in LDS history and gospel. He was aware of and sensitive to such developments, but never, in my experience, hostile or critical. Teaching students to think is tough, dangerous work. Teachers have lost their jobs, their lives, and even tenure because they believe students should be responsibly reflective. Lowell was not indifferent to knowledge. He simply believed knowledge was a highly desirable but secondary goal to the major purpose of intellectual activity. It is important for me to emphasize that Lowell was the walking, working example of his classroom. Lowell acted on his intelligence. He did in his writing, his university services, and extensive community services, his boys' ranch. All of these he exemplified and extended what he did in class. Evaluation for Lowell was behavior. It was not enough to smile and to speak happily about love and service. Lowell wanted to see it. He judged others in terms of what they gave of themselves, by the way individuals interacted with others, and even by the way one weeded a row of beets. He once gave my boy hell for not weeding really well up in the ranch up in We spent some long, agonizing hours together discussing the consequences and alternatives of some student misbehavior on that student behavior committee. Lowell was interested in what might help a student live more intelligently. Lowell was not interested in pain or punishment. He was interested in good, purposeful activity. He was not interested in lovely, empty rhetoric. I believe Lowell Bunyan, as good a teacher as he was in the conventional classroom setting, was far more influential as a teacher and exemplar in the community. One does not have to have been a student in his classes to have been a student in the community. Nor does one need to speculate about what being a student in Lowell's class was like, because it was not different from Lowell in life than anything Lowell did. Thank you.
When I went to the U, tuition was $100. It'd gone up threefold. Still a good bargain, however, compared to today. As I reflected on Lowell as a teacher, my mind turned to my grandfather, Milton Bunyan, his father, and some remarks I had made at the dedication of Milton Bunyan Hall. I was asked to represent the family and to speak for the family, and I said some things about Milton Bunyan which, when I reviewed, seemed very much to me to reflect the qualities of Lowell as well that made him such a remarkable teacher. I thought I'd just read a little bit of what I said about Lowell's father when I was a student up at the university many years ago. I think what impressed me most about my grandfather, and this impression becomes more meaningful to me with the passage of time, was the way in which profound religious faith and highly developed intellectuality blended in his life. He was a man of great learning, especially in the humanities and in the principles and practices of education. His thinking was remarkably disciplined and articulate. I used to marvel at his ability to elucidate complex problems and make penetrating observations. He had a great love for the life of the mind and sought to cultivate his intellectual resources all through life. What amazes me is the fact that he never gave the impression of being erudite, of being a bookish sort of academician. He never lost the common touch. The learned and those with little educational background felt equally comfortable in his presence. His manner was kind and warm. But Milton Bunyan left us more than a splendid intellectual legacy. He was committed to the belief that there is a transcendental spiritual reality and that man, in a very real sense, is a child of God. He had great faith in the validity of those sublime moral principles expressed in our Judeo-Christian heritage. His whole life was oriented around his religious commitments. He was not a dogmatist.
His religious faith did, however, give him a profound respect for human personality. Character education became a key word in his educational philosophy. He was a strong believer in the acquisition of knowledge and the training of the intellect through education, but he was also very much concerned with development of good citizenship, awakening the spirit of service, and inculcating high moral standards. His own life was a personification of his educational philosophy. I think I have never known anyone whose life faith and reason, spirituality and intellectuality have better expressed themselves in one integrated personality than in the life of my grandfather. I think Lowell adopted my grandfather as a role model to a very high degree, and so many of the qualities reflected in Milton Benyon I saw in Lowell Benyon as well, and resulted in a very remarkable impact he had on thousands of students over a period of many years. I'm going to reflect a little on some things that particularly impress me as I think about Lowell Benyon as a teacher. One is that he always seemed to me to be a fellow learner as well as a teacher. He had an inquiring, probing approach to topics under consideration. And it was as though he was searching himself for greater insight and better understanding as we would discuss things, even though he had gone over that many, many times in other classes with other students. He somehow had the ability to approach a class fresh, open, and with the hope that he himself could learn some new things as well as to impart his insights and share his insights with students. He was a very keen and focused listener, and he was able, I thought, remarkably to take student questions or responses and build on them, use them to them in ways that was validating to those that participated. He did not lecture very much. His method was more Socratic. He preferred, as Earl said, to stimulate with some questions or comments, thought, and to carry on a discussion rather than acting as a sage on the stage. He enjoyed thinking and interacting at the conceptual level, but also had a strong sense of the practical consequences of ideas. He moved back and forth between the abstract and the concrete easily and naturally. Hearing examples from his experience as a husband, a father, a part-time farmer, a student counselor, to illustrate abstract ideas helped us as students make connections between ideas that we were discussing and human experience and our own experience in particular. He connected very powerfully and individually with students. When he fastened his luminous and penetrating eyes on me, I had a strong sense that he cared deeply for me and deeply about what I thought. And as I talk with other students of his, they have the same impression, that even though we were in a group, somehow he had the ability to connect with us individually in the course of a class. He believed that students ought to think for themselves and ought to internalize the principles of the gospel in their own way. The one student response that tended to irritate him was, "What do we think?" And his response was always, "What do you think?" He just insisted that students not look for a
recipe kind of answer to important questions, but that they process questions themselves and find their own meaning and not look for others to hand them meaning. He believed he was aware of the strengths and limitations of the many avenues of knowledge and of learning. He could converse with students of science knowledgeably, intelligently about issues around the scientific method and how to reconcile faith with scientific inquiry. He could converse with students of philosophy and the social sciences with equal ease and understanding and insight, helping those of us who are in those fields sort out our religious faith in relation to our academic studies. He understood and respected scientific and philosophical inquiry and analysis. And he helped us work through tensions we sometimes felt between the life of the mind and the life of faith and religious feelings. As a man of keen intellect, great learning, and deep spirituality, he was a living testimony himself that students do not have to choose between faith and reason, that they both could be integrated in one life. Lowell had two great loves on earth, it seemed to me. The first was people, and the second, ideas, in that order. That combination of loves accounts to a large extent for the powerful and lasting impact of his teaching. He cared deeply for and about students and so much enjoyed sharing with them the excitement of learning. He was an extraordinary example of a lifelong learner. And never lost that wonderful characteristic of children, often lost in adulthood, which is a sense of wonder and a curiosity. Lowell's impact as a teacher extended beyond the formal classes of the Institute. During my college days, a group of students met regularly on a monthly basis, informally at his home on a Sunday evening, to continue the grand conversation we enjoyed so much in his classes. I don't remember just how those got organized. I think it was at his invitation. Lowell would typically get us started by raising some questions or making a few observations about some aspect of the gospel or education, and then the dialogue would begin. He was a master at stimulating discussion and keeping it focused and substantive. There was time for small talk, but we always ended up engaged in serious and lively discussion on some significant topic, with Lowell as a catalyst and a clarifier, but never as one who purported to have all the answers. In fact, he was as inclined to question answers as he was to propose possible answers. However, when pressed, he would freely share with us his judgment and his perspective on whatever we were discussing. Lowell spent countless hours with students individually when they would come to him for counsel, for advice, or for a sympathetic ear, which he freely gave. He was not quick to tell students what to think or how to think or what to do, but he had a marvelous ability to help students process their thinking and work through their problems. He listened intensely and sympathetically without judging and without taking over the responsibility of students for ultimately making their own decisions and assuming responsibility for those decisions. He conveyed in these one-on-one teaching sessions a profound respect for the dignity and agency of students. I experienced that personally from time to time, and I know others did as well. Noah reached out for insights and wisdom from many sources. It was not unusual for him in class to quote the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, Shakespeare, or Plato. One of his favorite quotes from the Bhagavad Gita is, "To action alone hast thou a right, not to its fruits." That thought has been a strength to me many times in my life when I worked hard at something and could see little or no fruits, sometimes thorns, at least in the short run. He drew moral, spiritual, and intellectual nourishment from sacred religious scripture, both Christian and non-Christian, from literature, philosophy, and the social sciences, from travel, which he did a good deal of, and from careful observation of human behavior. He shared freely with his students the many keen insights and perspectives he gained from his quest to discover and enjoy the highest and best treasures of the mind and spirit from both divine and human sources. Noah's extraordinary influence as a teacher was in part, I think, as Earl mentioned, due to the fact that he lived what he taught. When he spoke of integrity, he exuded integrity. When he spoke of the inherent worth of people, he related to people in a deeply caring way. He exemplified what he taught more than most teachers, in my experience. He modeled the ideals he espoused, and by so doing, showed us, his students, what these ideals look like in the life of a highly developed and well-integrated human being. When I think back on my days as a student of Lowe's, the phrase comes to me, "'Tis human fortune's happiest height to be a soul melodious, lucid, poised and whole, second in order of felicity to walk with such a soul. I count as one of my great blessings in life the privilege of walking and learning from and with Lowell Bunyan during several of the formative years of my youth and young adulthood. He stimulated and inspired me as few people have, and enlarged my vision of the possibilities of life and my life in particular. For that, I will be forever grateful to him." Well, that concludes Earl's and my effort to reflect on Lowell as a teacher. We do have some time. I'm sure there are people in here who also experienced him as a teacher and have some reflections about that. And I think I'd like to invite folks, if you feel so inclined, to share with us some of your own impressions. Yes?
I have a question.
Okay. Well, I'll take a shot at that, and maybe Earl would like to comment. One of the things that impressed me was that he not only was a man of faith, but he had a high regard for learning and for various ways by which knowledge is gained. He had a high regard for science and what it contributes and has contributed, for philosophy. He himself had been a student of philosophy and sociology. And so he was not only knowledgeable, but very respectful of different ways of trying to understand reality. And he could talk the language of scholars in various fields that use different realms of inquiry. So I never had the feeling that anybody had to make choices, you know, either or, but that there are different avenues for a better understanding the complexity and diversity of reality, and that we can learn a lot of important things through science. We can learn get a lot of important insights through the philosophers and those in the humanities, and that they can enrich and enhance our lives generally, and even give us better perspectives on the gospel, on religious truths, theological truths. So for him, and it's in that book, Religion and the Search for Truth, where he has a chapter on each of the various ways people learn things and the strengths and limitations of those ways and how they can supplement and complement one another. There's the story of the blind man feeling very different parts of the elephant. You know, the elephant representing reality, and as they felt different parts, they got very different views of what the elephant was like. And you know, he used that as a way of saying that reality is very complex, and we can learn a lot about it in different ways. So, that gave me a lot of comfort that, first of all, I didn't have to choose, and secondly, that what I was studying at the university had merit, and that it could enhance and supplement my faith and my religious background, and that they were not incompatible. Though there were areas that way of gaining knowledge could fully satisfy, and that there's things that we just have to hold in advance as well and learn to live with ambiguity. And I think he was quite comfortable with that, living with ambiguity and insisting that that's a very important thing people need to learn how to do.
The question is how, and there isn't a neat answer on page 41, paragraph 4. If there were, we would all know it. How to resolve and how to solve. And as good an answer as Lowell had, I think, is to use your head and your heart, and together with whomever, do what you can to work through the solution, knowing you will not get there totally in time. But feeling good in the process of getting there, and at least getting somewhere, maybe sometimes the answer. Many times I saw Lowell in the student behavior class quietly and carefully helping university students think through their own behavior, the consequences of their behavior, and trying to get them to formulate a life for themselves, where, frankly, in my youth, it was more my inclination to come in strong and wrong. And I was more inclined to be primitive, and I learned a lot from all that.
Can I just ask one follow-up to that?
Sure.
I also am just wondering how it was that he would help class stay focused or turn to a focus that was substantive and meaningful and not get kind of out on tangents that were strong and wrong a lot of times.
Well, part of it for me was the way he was able to take student questions or responses and use them to build toward or contribute to what he was hoping we would focus on. And just utilize them very, very thoughtfully and skillfully to keep on track and keep us moving. He was much less interested in information and facts than he was ideas and concepts. And though he recognized the need to have a factual base in order to understand a lot of things, the focus was on the ideas and concepts. And so he would just keep kind of bringing students back to whatever we were talking about, and using student comments in ways that that helped to keep us focused. And another thing that occurs to me also is a strong sense he had of just common sense, also as a way of a part of the equation. He used to quote an old farmer, I guess he knew, that said, "I don't believe anything that doesn't make good horses' senses." And that was one of his criterion, that common sense is also an important criterion for making judgments. Yes? Yeah, and that was my point about his being a fellow learner as well as a teacher. He just seemed to be interested in trying to improve his own insights and his own understanding and enlarge his own perspective, even on things that he had gone around a lot of times with a lot of students. He still had that curiosity about trying to get a better understanding. A very good point. Yes? If you want to be recorded forever, then you must come down and speak through this. Bob?
I already gave some one-liners this morning, but I've thought of a dozen others since then. I won't give a couple.
And I began thinking of those mostly when I heard your question over here as to specifics. I wish I could remember more about exactly how he conducted this interview with me, but all I can say is when I first came to the U, I didn't know I did know some people, but I didn't know very many. I was from New York, and I was wondering whether I should join a fraternity. So after one of the classes, I went up to Brother Benyon, and I asked him if he could give me some advice, and we talked for just a few seconds, and then he said, "Come on over here, let's talk for a while." And we went right across the hall into that vacant classroom right there at the front of the Institute building on University Street, and I guess we sat there for over an hour. It must have been close to an hour and a half. And here was the thing that was helped me the most, that was so remarkable, was here was this man that was in charge of the entire Institute of Religion with all these hundreds of students, and he was just leaning back in his chair as though he hadn't had any other care in the world, and he devoted his whole attention to me and what I felt and what I thought, what my hopes and dreams and ambitions were. And I think that respect for the student really made a good impression on me, and I tried to apply that whenever I am in a counseling situation, that if you really take a sincere interest in the person you are counseling, and then that really helps a lot. And his language was very simple. He didn't use a lot of highfalutin jargon. He was very simple and down to earth. And I used to say, "Gosh, Brother Benyon, I really enjoy your classes." And he said, "Well, I like to organize ideas. I like to organize ideas," and that really appealed to me because I like to put things in kind of a framework to so that helped me to remember things. And here are some of the things that he taught me that I've never forgotten. He used to say, and these were in classes where he was teaching teachers how to teach. He said, "Remember, we're teaching people, not lessons." And his three great loyalties, that really made an impression on me. And then as John referred to in Religion and the Pursuit of Truth, when I read that book, boy, that just got me going. I gave a whole month's worth of Elder's Quorum lessons on that. The Four Avenues to Truth, he told me that wasn't original with him, but it was original with me hearing it for the first time. The Four Great Avenues to Truth, Authority, Reason, Experience, and Feeling. And that the truths that are the most secure in our lives are those that are validated through all four of those paths. And that got my mind going, and I prepared a chart of all these teachings of the church that I had problems with on one side, and then the four avenues down the other side, and on the scale of 1 to 10, how they stood up. I mean, it really got me going. And, of course, we all are familiar with one of his statements in that book where he said, don't look at the Bible. The Bible wasn't intended as a scientific text when you're, you know, trying to make all kinds of the theories of creation and evolution and so forth out of it. One thing that was very sensitive at that time, we wouldn't think much about it today, but in our class on marriage and family relations, that was back in, I was back in the early 50s, and that was a time when, you know, you didn't talk much about sex and things like that, but he came right out, and when it came time, you know, it wasn't the big focus of his whole course, but when it came time to talk about sex, he said, you know, he taught the three great purposes of sex: procreation, health, and to cement the bond between the partners. And I don't know, I just the whole thing together I really related to, and it's affected me, you know, that was 42 years ago, and it's affected me ever since. Thank you.
Val, did you have something? You want to come up? Val Rust is a former colleague of mine in the West German mission.
That destroys the pedagogical moment, you realize.
I think the microphones are the death of the pedagogical experience in a classroom. I was a colleague and a contemporary of John and Bob, and we were the ones who joined together on those Sunday evening meetings with Lowell. But I wanted to stress one thing, and that is, even though his pedagogy is open-ended, is one of the inquiry. The thing that astounded me is that we would meet in those open-ended, beautiful discussions where everyone was contributing, and a year later, a volume or a manual or something would appear in which Lowell Benyon had encapsulated all of those ideas into a meaningful whole. And that, to me, is really significant, that that our life is not entirely one of simply open-ended excursion, but we eventually come to a resolution, temporarily at least, of those and begin to conceptualize those in some kind of framework that makes sense to us, that is meaningful to other people, that can help us in our own further inquiry. And I think that's a critical dimension of his pedagogical activity, is that he is not just open-ended, but he's seeking seriously and attempting to synthesize that into a meaningful whole. Thank you.
Well, you turned that into a very good pedagogical moment after all. Well, anybody else like to make a comment or raise a question? Jen? He would do that. I don't blame him for that if you didn't like it, but I think he did that. He really did try to stimulate us to think and to kind of get out of our boxes and enlarge our perspective.
His ability to ask Socratic questions that helped you along. When I was at the Institute, I had two proposals of marriage, went to Lowell, described each one, asked for his advice. He thought a minute and he said, "What makes you think you have to take either one? You can choose not to choose." And that, I suddenly realized, yes, of course. And I went out took him about 1 minute to counsel me. I realized how he was able to counsel so many people because he knew how to focus in on the person, pay close attention. Most of us are thinking about 45 other things as we focus. He wasn't. He knew how to focus on what was there. And then ask one question that will get you thinking, and you go out thinking you've solved it. And of course, he knew that if I had two choices, I probably didn't want to take either one. And when I finally did decide on a person, I didn't ask his advice. I just came over to visit and told him about it.
The final choice was not one of the two, is that right? Thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
I thought if Mary would come up, I'd come back. If you come back this evening, Mary and I are going to punish you further. But I'm Dick Winters. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Services Council. I have the honor of following role in that assignment. And I've had today, as I have fringed these meetings up here, talking about Lowell, just a flood of memories that go back through the years. And I don't know how much time I'll have tonight, but I won't get to share all of them, I'm sure. But the way Lowell taught, I mean, he was always asking questions that you really did know the answers to, but you just had to formulate those and spit them out. And it was in June in 1984 that I had one of the very low points in my life. I was serving at the time on the Board of Directors of the Community Services Council. Lowell had invited me to do that, and I had accepted that. But I was just kind of brand new on the council and just getting my feet wet. And we had one of the great tragedies in our life. And if you don't know that life has got a lot of bummers in it, just look around. My favorite bumper sticker was one I read on the morning of my oldest son's funeral. I was on my way to church and feeling about that tall, and the bumper sticker was there, and I thought, well, I'll just read that and get my mind off this crazy world. And I got up close enough. It was small print, and I got up close enough, and there was a fellow in a platform rocker on one side with his hands cocked behind his head, obviously just rocking away. And on the other side, it says, "The only reason I'm holding on to life is to find out what the hell's coming next." So on the worst day of my life, I'm driving down 15th East to the Edgefield Road, absolutely roaring. But Lowell spent some time with me at that time. My oldest son took his life, and it was a very, very disastrous experience for us. And Lowell, in the great way he counseled, told me that there were many victims of a suicide. He said, what you have to do is get your name off the victim list and get it on the survivor list. And you need to do that as quickly as you can. He said, well, there are many victims. And after his counsel, I started looking around to see if I could identify other victims. I had no problem with family members because they were very readily identified. I had a sheriff up in Rich County. This had occurred up on Bear Lake, and he wanted me to do a few things so he could close his file, and I was annoyed at him, but I knew I had to do something. And so I gave my wife and my kids a big hug, and I took off. And driving up there with the things that Lowell had said stirring through my mind, I thought, I wonder how many victims there are up there of this event. And so after I'd gotten rid of the sheriff and done the things that he wanted me to do, I went around and I found the people who were on the ambulance that night. Rich County has a little emergency medical response team. And there was one young lady that was her first night on the ambulance. And she had vowed, and it had reached the other members of the team, that she was never going out again. So I sat, and I held her for a while. I told her there were people out there that needed her, and that she needed to go back out on that ambulance. And I tried to raise questions as to who it was that was going to help those that were in need. Parroting things that I think Lowell might have said under the same kinds of circumstances. When I left that young lady, she had promised me that she would be out on the ambulance the next night. And I went around and made calls on all the people that had interfaced with Rich at the time of his death. A friend who had found him. It took me a little while to put them back together. There were two of them. But life goes on. Things don't change just because there are a few problems we encounter. And the gospel teaches us that it doesn't matter what's coming down the line. If we have an understanding, appreciation for those principles, we can deal with whatever it is. And that was one of the great lessons that I learned at the side of that dear man, Lowell Bunyan. And I have a great respect and a great admiration for him. He is one of a kind. I don't know that anybody would want the assignment to try to be a Lowell Bunyan. I'm certainly not as intellectually or spiritually or any other way even approach the depth and the level of Lowell's performance in this life. Mary asked me one time when I made a very interesting observation as she was doing research about Lowell's biography that I didn't think Lowell had ever asked anybody for money one-on-one. You know, eyeball to eyeball, get your checkbook out and write a check, I need your help. It was against his principles. The first beneficiary of a contribution had to be the giver. And if you had to put a step over toehold on the giver to exact a contribution from him, that element that was so essential in Lowell's thinking was gone. And so I thought if he'd ever ask anybody, it would probably be his friend Obert Tanner. And so I called Obert, asked if I could meet him, and told him I wanted to talk about Lowell. And he did whatever he had to do to adjust his schedule and invited me down that afternoon. I right into Obert's office. We had quite an interesting discussion. And in the course of it, I observed for Obert that my mother had had and just treasured a copy of Christ's Ideals for Living. And this was a Sunday school manual that Obert had written, I guess, back in the 40s. And it's in print again. I don't know which one of my sisters got away with the original copy Mother had, but I have my own copy now. It's been reprinted by the Tanner Foundation. But at the conclusion of that visit, Obert Tanner looked at me and he said, the Savior set the standard. I wrote the manual, and Lowell lived the life. And I thought coming from Obert, that was a very, very, very poignant observation of the life of this very delightful man. And come back tonight anyway. Mary's going to have something to say.
Thank you, Dick, for sharing that. Dick really is carrying on the legacy in a wonderful way. Well, our time is about up, unless there are no burning desire to comment. Thank you for coming and sharing and allowing us to share and reflect upon the life of a marvelous teacher.